Correct. And it was a momentary victory for your side. But there was still time for me to worm the truth from your man Channis, and still wisdom in me to realize that such a truth might exist. And on our side, oh, not quite sufficiently subtle one, was the realization that you might go that one step further. And so Bail Channis was prepared for you. That he most certainly was not, for I stripped his brain clean as any plucked chicken. It quivered bare and open before me, and when he said Rossum was the second foundation, it was basic truth, for I had ground him so flat and smooth that not the smidgen of a deceit could have found refuge in any microscopic crevice. True enough. So much the better for our foresight. For I have told you already that Bail Channis was a volunteer. Do you know what sort of a volunteer? Before he left our foundation for Calgan, and you, he submitted to emotional surgery of a drastic nature. Do you think it was sufficient to deceive you? Do you think Bail Channis, mentally untouched, could possibly deceive you? No. Bail Channis was himself deceived, of necessity and voluntarily. Down to the inmost core of his mind, Bail Channis honestly believes that Rossum is the second foundation. And for 3 years now, we of the second foundation have built up the appearance of that, here in the kingdom of Tazenda, in preparation and waiting for you. And we have succeeded, have we not? You penetrated to Tazenda, and beyond that to Rossem. But past that, you could not go. The mule was upon his feet. You dare tell me that Rossem also is not the second foundation? Channis, from the floor, felt his bonds burst for good, under a stream of mental force on the part of the first speaker, and strained upright. He let out one long, incredulous cry. You mean Rossem is not the second foundation? The memories of life, the knowledge of his mind, everything, whirled mistily about him in confusion. The first speaker smiled. You see, first citizen, Channis is as upset as you are. Of course, Rossem is not the second foundation. Are we madmen, then, to lead you, our greatest, most powerful, most dangerous enemy to our world? Oh, no. Let your fleet bombard Rossem, first citizen, if you must have it so. Let them destroy all they can. For at most, they can kill only Channis and myself. And that will leave you in a situation improved, not in the least. For the Second Foundation's expedition to Rossem, which has been here for 3 years and has functioned temporarily as elders in this village, embarked yesterday, and are returning to Calgan. They will evade your fleet, of course, and they will arrive in Calgan at least a day before you can, which is why I tell you all this. Unless I countermand my orders, when you return, you will find a revolting empire, a disintegrated realm, and only the men with you in your fleet here will be loyal to you. They will be hopelessly outnumbered. And moreover, the men of the Second Foundation will be with your home fleet, and we'll see to it that you reconvert no one. Your empire is done, mutant. Slowly the mule bowed his head, as anger and despair cornered his mind completely. Yes, too late, too late. Now I see it. Now you see it, agreed the first speaker. And now you don't. In the despair of that moment, when the mule's mind lay open, the first speaker, ready for that moment and pre-sure of its nature, entered quickly. It required a rather insignificant fraction of a second to consummate the change completely. The mule looked up and said, Then I shall return to Calgan? Certainly. How do you feel? Excellently well. His brow puckered. Who are you? Does it matter? Of course not. He dismissed the matter and touched Pritchard's shoulder. Wake up, Pritchard. We're going home. It was 2 hours later that Bail Channis felt strong enough to walk by himself. He said, Won't he ever remember? Never. He retains his mental powers and his empire, but his motivations are now entirely different. The notion of a second foundation is a blank to him, and he is a man of peace. He will be a far happier man henceforward, too, for the few years of life left him by his maladjusted physique. And then, after he is dead, Selden's plan will go on. Somehow. And it is true, urged Channis. It is true that Rossem is not the second foundation. I could swear, I tell you, I know it is. I am not mad. You are not mad, Channis. Merely, as I have said, changed. Rossem is not the second foundation. Come, we too will return home. Last interlude. Bail Channis sat in the small white-tiled room and allowed his mind to relax. He was content to live in the present. There were the walls and the window and the grass outside. They had no names. They were just things. There was a bed and a chair and books that developed themselves idly on the screen at the foot of his bed. There was the nurse who brought him his food. At first he had made efforts to piece together the scraps of things he had heard, such as those two men talking together. One had said, "Complete aphasia now. It's cleaned out, and I think without damage. It will only be necessary to return the recording of his original brainwave makeup." He remembered the sounds by rote, and for some reason they seemed peculiar sounds, as if they meant something. But why bother? Better to watch the pretty changing colors on the screen at the foot of the thing he lay on. And then someone entered and did things to him, and for a long time he slept. And when that had passed, the bed was suddenly a bed, and he knew he was in a hospital, and the words he remembered made sense. He sat up. "What's happening?" The first speaker was beside him. "You're on the second foundation, and you have your mind back. Your original mind." "Yes. Yes!" Channis came to the realization that he was himself, and there was incredible triumph and joy in that. "And now tell me," said the first speaker, "do you know where the second foundation is now?" And the truth came flooding down in one enormous wave, and Channis did not answer. Like Ebling Miz before him, he was conscious of only one vast, numbing surprise, until he finally nodded and said, "By the stars of the galaxy, now I know!" Part 2. Search by the Foundation. Chapter 7. Arcadia. Daryl Arcady, novelist, born 11-5-362 F.E., died 1-7-443 F.E. Although primarily a writer of fiction, Arcady Daryl is best known for her biography of her grandmother, Beta Daryl. Based on first-hand information, it has for centuries served as a primary source of information concerning the mule and his times. Like Unkeyed Memories, her novel Time and Time and Over is a stirring reflection of the brilliant Kalganian society of the early interregnum, based, it is said, on a visit to Kalgan in her youth. Encyclopedia Galactica. Arcadia Daryl declaimed firmly into the mouthpiece of her transcriber, "The Future of Selden's Plan," by A. Daryl, and then thought darkly that someday, when she was a great writer, she would write all her masterpieces under the pseudonym of Arcady. Just Arcady. No last name at all. A. Daryl would be just the sort of thing that she would have to put on all her themes for her class in composition and rhetoric. So tasteless. All the other kids had to do it, too, except for Olynthus Dam, because the class laughed so when he did it the first time. And Arcadia was a little girl's name, wished on her because her great-grandmother had been called that. Her parents just had no imagination at all. Now that she was 2 days past 14, you'd think they'd recognize the simple fact of adulthood and call her Arcady. Her lips tightened as she thought of her father looking up from his book viewer just long enough to say, "But if you're going to pretend you're 19, Arcadia, what will you do when you're 25 and all the boys think you're 30? From where she sprawled across the arms and into the hollow of her own special armchair, she could see the mirror on her dresser. Her foot was a little in the way, because her house slipper kept twirling about her big toe. So she pulled it in, and sat up with an unnatural straightness to her neck, that she felt sure, somehow, lengthened it a full 2 inches into slim regality. For a moment she considered her face thoughtfully. Too fat. She opened her jaws half an inch behind closed lips, and caught the resultant trace of unnatural gauntness at every angle. She licked her lips with a quick touch of tongue, and let them pout a bit in moist softness. Then she let her eyelids droop in a weary, worldly way. Oh, golly, if only her cheeks weren't that silly pink! She tried putting her fingers to the outer corners of her eye and tilting the lids a bit to get that mysterious, exotic languor of the women of the inner star systems, but her hands were in the way, and she couldn't see her face very well. Then she lifted her chin, caught herself at half profile, and with her eyes a little strained from looking out the corner and her neck muscles faintly aching, She said in a voice one octave below its natural pitch, "Really, Father, if you think it makes a particle of difference to me what some silly old boys think, you just..." And then she remembered that she still had the transmitter open in her hand and said drearily, "Oh, golly," and shut it off. The faintly violet paper with the peach margin line on the left had upon it the following: "The future of Selden's plan. Really, Father, if you think it makes a particle of difference to me what some silly old boys think, you just... Oh, golly." She pulled the sheet out of the machine with annoyance, and another clicked neatly into place. But her face smoothed out of its vexation nevertheless, and her wide little mouth stretched into a self-satisfied smile. She sniffed at the paper delicately. Just right. Just that proper touch of elegance and charm. And the penmanship was just the last word. The machine had been delivered 2 days ago on her first adult birthday. She had said, "But Father, everybody, just everybody in the class who has the slightest pretensions to being anybody has one. Nobody but some old drips would use hand machines." The salesman had said, "There is no other model as compact on the one hand and as adaptable on the other. It will spell and punctuate correctly according to the sense of the sentence. Naturally, it is a great aid to education, since it encourages the user to employ careful enunciation and breathing in order to make sure of the correct spelling, to say nothing of demanding a proper and elegant delivery for correct punctuation." Even then, her father had tried to get one geared for type print, as if she were some dried-up old maid teacher. But when it was delivered, it was the model she wanted, obtained perhaps with a little more wail and sniffle than quite went with the adulthood of 14, and copy was turned out in a charming and entirely feminine handwriting, with the most beautifully graceful capitals anyone ever saw. Even the phrase, "Oh, golly," somehow breathed glamour when the transcriber was done with it. But just the same, she had to get it right. So she sat up straight in her chair, placed her first draft before her in businesslike fashion, and began again, crisply and clearly. Her abdomen flat, her chest lifted, and her breathing carefully controlled, she intoned, with dramatic fervor, "The future of Selden's plan. The Foundation's past history is, I am sure, well known to all of us who have had the good fortune to be educated in our planet's efficient and well-staffed school system." There, that would start things off right with Miss Earle King, that mean old hag. "That past history is largely the past history of the great plan of Harry Selden. The two are one. But the question in the mind of most people today is whether this plan will continue in all its great wisdom, or whether it will be foully destroyed, or, perhaps, has been so destroyed already. To understand this, it may be best to pass quickly over some of the highlights of the plan as it has been revealed to humanity thus far." This part was easy, because she had taken modern history the semester before. "In the days, nearly 4 centuries ago, when the first galactic empire was decaying into the paralysis that preceded final death, one man, the great Harry Selden, foresaw the approaching end. Through the science of psychohistory, the intricacies of whose mathematics has long since been forgotten..." She paused in a trifle of doubt. She was sure that intricacies was pronounced with soft C's, but the spelling didn't look right. Oh well, the machine couldn't very well be wrong. "He and the men who worked with him are able to foretell the course of the great social and economic currents sweeping the galaxy at the time. It was possible for them to realize that, left to itself, the empire would break up, and that thereafter there would be at least 30,000 years of anarchic chaos prior to the establishment of a new empire. It was too late to prevent the great fall, but it was still possible, at least, to cut short the intermediate period of chaos. The plan was, therefore, evolved whereby only a single millennium would separate the Second Empire from the First. We are completing the 4th century of that millennium, and many generations of men have lived and died, while the plan has continued its inexorable workings. Harry Selden established 2 foundations at the opposite ends of the galaxy, in a manner and under such circumstances as would yield the best mathematical solution for his psychohistorical problem. In one of these, our foundation, established here on Terminus, there was concentrated the physical science of the empire, and through the possession of that science, the foundation was able to withstand the attacks of the barbarous kingdoms which had broken away and become independent, out at the fringe of the empire. The foundation, indeed, was able to conquer in its turn these short-lived kingdoms, by means of the leadership of a series of wise and heroic men, like Salvor Hardin and Hober Mallow, who were able to interpret the plan intelligently and to guide our land through its... She had written intricacies here also, but decided not to risk it a second time. Complications. All our planets still revere their memories, although centuries have passed. Eventually, the Foundation established a commercial system which controlled a large portion of the Siwenian and Anacreonian sectors of the galaxy, and even defeated the remnants of the old empire under its last great general, Bel Rios. It seemed that nothing could now stop the workings of Selden's plan. Every crisis that Selden had planned had come at its appropriate time and had been solved. And with each solution, the Foundation had taken another giant stride toward Second Empire and peace. And then, her breath came short at this point, and she hissed the words between her teeth, but the transmitter simply wrote them, calmly and gracefully. With the last remnants of the dead First Empire gone, and with only ineffectual warlords ruling over the splinters and remnants of the decayed Colossus. She got that phrase out of a thriller on the video last week, but old Miss Earl King never listened to anything but symphonies and lectures, so she'd never know. There came the mule. This strange man was not allowed for in the plan. He was a mutant, whose birth could not have been predicted. He had the strange and mysterious power of controlling and manipulating human emotions, and in this manner could bend all men to his will. With breathtaking swiftness, he became a conqueror and empire builder, until finally, he even defeated the Foundation itself. Yet he never obtained universal dominion, since in his first overpowering lunge, he was stopped by the wisdom and daring of a great woman. Now there was that old problem again. Father would insist that she never bring up the fact that she was the grandchild of Beta Darrell. Everyone knew it, and Beta was just about the greatest woman there ever was, and she had stopped the mule single-handed. In a manner, the true story of which is known in its entirety to very few. There, if she had to read it to the class, that last could be said in a dark voice, and someone would be sure to ask what the true story was, and then, well, and then she couldn't help tell the truth if they asked her, could she? In her mind, she was already wordlessly whizzing through a hurt and eloquent explanation to a stern and questioning paternal parent. After 5 years of restricted rule, another change took place, the reasons for which are not known, and the mule abandoned all plans for further conquest. His last 5 years were those of an enlightened despot. It is said by some that the change in the mule was brought about by the intervention of the Second Foundation. However, no man has ever discovered the exact location of this other foundation, nor knows its exact function, so that theory remains unproven. A whole generation has passed since the death of the mule. What of the future, then, now that he has come and gone? He interrupted Selden's plan and seemed to have burst it to fragments. Yet as soon as he died, the Foundation rose again, like a nova from the dead ashes of a dying star. She had made that up herself. Once again, the planet Terminus houses the center of a commercial federation, almost as great and as rich as before the conquest, and even more peaceful and democratic. Is this planned? Is Selden's great dream still alive? And will a second galactic empire yet be formed 600 years from now? I, myself, believe so. Because, this was the important part, Miss Earl King always had those large, ugly red pencil scrawls that went, "But this is only descriptive. What are your personal reactions? Think, express yourself, penetrate your own soul." Penetrate your own soul. A lot she knew about souls, with her lemon face that never smiled in its life. Never at any time has the political situation been so favorable. The old empire is completely dead, and the period of the mule's rule put an end to the era of warlords that preceded him. Most of the surrounding portions of the galaxy are civilized and peaceful. Moreover, the internal health of the Foundation is better than ever before. The despotic times of the pre-conquest hereditary mayors have given way to the democratic elections of early times. There are no longer dissident worlds of independent traders, no longer the injustices and dislocations that accompanied accumulations of great wealth in the hands of a few. There is no reason, therefore, to fear failure, unless it is true that the Second Foundation itself presents a danger. Those who think so have no evidence to back their claim, but merely vague fears and superstitions. I think that our confidence in ourselves, in our nation, and in Harry Seldon's great plan should drive from our hearts and minds all uncertainties and... this was awfully corny, but something like this was expected at the end. So I say, that is as far as the future of Selden's plan got at that moment, because there was the gentlest little tap on the window, and when Arcadia shot up to balance on one arm of the chair, she found herself confronted by a smiling face beyond the glass, its even symmetry of feature interestingly accentuated by the short, vertical line of a finger before its lips. With a slight pause necessary to assume an attitude of bepuzzlement, Arcadia dismounted from the armchair, walked to the couch that fronted the wide window that held the apparition, and, kneeling upon it, stared out thoughtfully. The smile upon the man's face faded quickly. While the fingers of one hand tightened whitely upon the sill, the other made a quick gesture. Arcadia obeyed calmly, and closed the latch that moved the lower third of the window smoothly into its socket in the wall, allowing the warm spring air to interfere with the conditioning within. "You can't get in," she said with comfortable smugness. "The windows are all screened and keyed only to people who belong here. If you come in, all sorts of alarms will break loose." A pause. Then she added, "You look sort of silly balancing on that ledge underneath the window. If you're not careful, you'll fall and break your neck and a lot of valuable flowers." "In that case," said the man at the window, who had been thinking that very thing, with a slightly different arrangement of adjectives, "will you shut off the screen and let me in?" "No use in doing that," said Arcadia. "You're probably thinking of a different house, because I'm not the kind of girl who lets strange men into her bedroom this time of night." Her eyes, as she said it, took on a heavy-lidded sultriness, or an unreasonable facsimile thereof. All traces of humor whatever had disappeared from the young stranger's face. He muttered, "This is Dr. Darrell's house, isn't it? Why should I tell you?" "Oh, Galaxy, goodbye. If you jump off, young man, I will personally give the alarm." This was intended as a refined and sophisticated thrust of irony, since to Arcadia's enlightened eyes, the intruder was an obviously mature 30 at least. Quite elderly, in fact. Quite a pause. Then, tightly, he said, "Well, now, look here, girlie. If you don't want me to stay, and don't want me to go, what do you want me to do? You can come in, I suppose. Dr. Darrell does live here. I'll shut off the screen now." Warily, after a searching look, the young man poked his head through the window, then hunched himself up and through it. He brushed at his knees with an angry, slapping gesture, and lifted a reddened face at her. "You're quite sure that your character and reputation won't suffer when they find me here, are you?" "Not as much as yours would, because just as soon as I hear footsteps outside, I'll just shout and yell and say you forced your way in here." "Yes," he replied with heavy courtesy. "And how do you intend to explain the shut-off protective screen?" "Poof, that would be easy. There wasn't any there in the first place." The man's eyes were wide with chagrin. "That was a bluff?" "How old are you, kid?" "I consider that a very impertinent question, young man. And I am not accustomed to being addressed as kid."
"I don't wonder. You're probably the mule's grandmother in disguise. Do you mind if I leave now before you arrange a lynching party with myself as star performer?"
"You'd better not leave, because my father's expecting you."
The man's look became a wary one again. An eyebrow shot up as he said lightly,
"Oh? Anyone with your father?"
"No."
"Anyone called on him lately?"
"Only tradespeople.
And you?"
"Anything unusual happen at all?"
"Only you.
Forget me, will you?"
"No, don't forget me. Tell me, how did you know your father was expecting me?"
"Oh, that was easy. Last week he received a personal capsule, keyed to him personally with a self-oxidizing message, you know. He threw the capsule shell into the trash decinto, and yesterday he gave Polly, that's our major, see, a month's vacation so she could visit her sister in Terminus City. And this afternoon he made up the bed in the spare room. So I knew he expected somebody that I wasn't supposed to know anything about. Usually he tells me everything."
"Really? I'm surprised he has to. I should think you'd know everything before he tells you."
"I usually do."
Then she laughed. She was beginning to feel very much at ease. The visitor was elderly, but very distinguished looking, with curly brown hair and very blue eyes. Maybe she could meet somebody like that again, sometimes, when she was old herself.
And just how? He asked. Did you know it was I he expected?
Well, who else could it be?
He was expecting somebody in so secrety a way, if you know what I mean. And then you came gumping around trying to sneak through windows instead of walking through the front door, the way you would if you had any sense. She remembered a favorite line and used it promptly. Men are so stupid. Pretty stuck on yourself, aren't you, kid? I mean, miss, you could be wrong, you know. What if I told you that all this is a mystery to me, and that as far as I know, your father is expecting someone else, not me?
Oh, I don't think so. I didn't ask you to come in until after I saw you drop your briefcase.
My what?
Your briefcase, young man. I'm not blind. You didn't drop it by accident because you looked down first, so as to make sure it would land right.
Then you must have realized it would land just under the hedges and wouldn't be seen, so you dropped it and didn't look down afterwards. Now, since you came to the window instead of the front door, it must mean that you were a little afraid to trust yourself in the house before investigating the place. And after you had a little trouble with me, you took care of your briefcase before taking care of yourself, which means that you consider whatever your briefcase has in it to be more valuable than your own safety. And that means that as long as you're in here and the briefcase is out there, and we know that it's out there, you're probably pretty helpless. She paused for a much-needed breath, and the man said grittily, "Except that I think I'll choke you just about medium dead and get out of here with the briefcase. Except, young man, that I happen to have a baseball bat under my bed, which I can reach in 2 seconds from where I'm sitting, and I'm very strong for a girl."
Impasse. Finally, with a strained courtesy, the young man said, "Shall I introduce myself, since we're being so chummy? I'm Peleus Anthor. And your name?"
"I'm Arcady Darrell. Pleased to meet you. And now, Arcady, would you be a good little girl and call your father?"
Arcadia bridled.
"I'm not a little girl. I think you're very rude, especially when you're asking a favor."
Peleus Anthor sighed. "Very well. Would you be a good, kind, dear, little old lady, just chock full of lavender, and call your father?"
"That's not what I meant either, but I'll call him. Only not so I'll take my eyes off you, young man." And she stamped on the floor.
There came the sound of hurrying footsteps in the hall, and the door was flung open.
"Arcadia!"
There was a tiny explosion of exhaled air, and Dr. Darrell said,
"Who are you, sir?"
Peleus sprang to his feet in what was quite obviously relief.
"Dr. Torrin Darrell, I'm Peleus Anthor. You've received word about me, I think. At least your daughter says you have."
"My daughter says I have?" He bent a frowning glance at her, which caromed harmlessly off the wide-eyed and impenetrable web of innocence with which she met the accusation.
Dr. Darrell said finally, "I have been expecting you. Would you mind coming down with me, please?"
And he stopped as his eye caught a flicker of motion, which Arcadia caught simultaneously. She scrambled towards her transcriber, but it was quite useless, since her father was standing right next to it. He said sweetly, "You've left it going all this time, Arcadia."
"Father," she squeaked in real anguish, "it is very ungentlemanly to read another person's private correspondence, especially when it's talking correspondence."
"Ah," said her father, "but talking correspondence with a strange man in your bedroom. As a father, Arcadia, I must protect you against evil."
"Oh, golly, it was nothing like that."
Peleus laughed suddenly. "Oh, but it was, Dr. Darrell. The young lady was going to accuse me of all sorts of things, and I must insist that you read it, if only to clear my name."
"Oh."
Arcadia held back her tears with an effort. Her own father didn't even trust her. And that darn transcriber, if that silly fool hadn't come gooping at the window and making her forget to turn it off, and now her father would be making long, gentle speeches about what young ladies aren't supposed to do. There just wasn't anything they were supposed to do, it looked like. Except choke and die, maybe.
This book is continued on cassette number 4.